Everybody tell me.
No, they didn't. The people themselves did not want me to leave, but as a necessity, you know. They felt that if anyone could tell the story about what was going on in Greenwood, it was me, because it was my project. I was the first to go into Greenwood.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, as you know, we got Dick Gregory and Harry Belafonte and Lucinda Poitier and others began to pour food into Greenwood. And the mass marches really began to take place then. And
so you were absent during a lot of that time?
Yes, I was absent.
I wondered why you weren't in the papers that time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was absent a lot of that time. Raising money.
Mm-hmm.
All, you know.
Did it help having all that activity going on while you were out raising
yes,
money?
Yes, helped tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, too, in 63, I think just about the time, Look magazine had just come out with a three-page story on me, and I was in demand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, across the country.
So, if you remember, at the climax after a series of marches, they arrested most of the SNCC leadership,
right.
Foreman Moses,
yes,
Guillot,
Peacock, and some local Greenwood people.
Right. Jones, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the famous Greenwood deal, where the Justice Department agreed to drop the injunction. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
Mm-hmm.
Vaguely.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we went to Washington after the arrest, and we filed suit against the Justice Department, because they failed to protect the lives of civil rights workers in Greenwood. And at that time, too, I was still on the road a lot. And the irony of that, you know, is it never really got me in the press. It really never, there was one thing when I got to New York that night. We saw one little thing on television, but that's all. It was completely almost blacked out.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came back to Greenwood, and that's where we went into Holmes County.
Okay. Yeah, you asked a little bit about, you know, it's hard to talk to other people, but about your relationship during the early part with people like Moses and Foreman. What did you think of Moses when you first met him?
I didn't believe Moses. A man who had gone through the kind of things that Moses had gone through. And with the educational background that Moses had, and you know, here's a man who really didn't have to be in the South,
mm-hmm.
but who was here and committed. And I always wanted to pattern myself in mannerism and everything as Moses himself was. I saw the man go through a lot of things that was just unnecessary. A lot of frustrations, a lot of problems were placed on him, and he endured it all. I just felt that here's a man that, you know, as being a person who was born and grew up in the churches, you know, here's a man, as my mother and father knew, would say, who was God sent. You know, and I just saw Bob as being that person, you know, who was really just like Moses, who had gone in the Red Seas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I still respect it. Today, I respect Bob Moses in terms of all the people that went through the movement more than I do anyone else that I know. That's still today.
Mm-hmm.
The man was truly committed. Truly committed.
When you said some of the burdens weren't necessary, you thought too much stuff was put on Bob? Or?
Everything was put on Bob.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. If people... almost if people wanted to go and eat, little things like that. Or when it came to trying to get money in, or when it came to trying to get people into Mississippi for the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project. Anything that had to be done, Bob would be the first person to be approached instead of Chuck McDew or John Lewis or Julian or James Foreman. Bob was the person. And he carried all the responsibilities of the organization of the movement. And not only of the movement, of all of us who were SNCC field secretaries. We looked to Bob. If we wanted anything to be done, and we needed something, if it wasn't the $15, we would look to Bob. And he tried. He would never say no. I never heard him say no.
What about Foreman? What kind of presence was he, you think, within the organization?
Foreman's presence wasn't as visible or wasn't as highly visible as Bob's. Foreman would spend a lot of time traveling around the state of Mississippi and other parts of the country speaking, you know, raising money, food, what have you, and bringing other people into the movement. All of the organizational skills and strategies seem to have come from Bob. He would be the initiator. And people would follow because he seemed to have had innate leadership qualities. And the things that Bob would say would be the most soundest and the most practical and the most wisest thing to do. And because Bob had spent time in Macomb and things, and you know, we felt that Bob too had learned a lot, you know, he knew. And Jim seemed to have been the kind of person who would be more concerned about technicalities and bullshit like that, vis-a-vis that about it.
Mm-hmm. Let me go back to Greenway for a minute. Seen from talking to some people that after Reverend Johnson's church, which was the first church,
right,
the next churches to open up were the Methodist churches.
Yes.
But you all had trouble with the Baptist churches.
We had trouble with all of the Baptist churches in the Genesis. The next church opened up was Turner Chapel. And they had a young minister there, a young Methodist man, who became a part of the movement and was...
This is Reverend Tucker?
Reverend Tucker. Reverend Tucker. And the what really brought other people closer to the movement was when they saw police sick the dogs on Reverend Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
So now here's a man who goes up in the cloth as a child of God. They sick the dogs on him.
Mm-hmm. There's a statement on the story of Greenwood, the album that was put together.
Oh yeah.
Mr. Jordan talking about
the same dog that Nick Bob's blood.
Yeah. Yeah. But talking about how he talked about how it changed people's minds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did. It really changed people's minds. It gave them a deeper feeling for the movement itself. And it made people want to be involved who were not even involved. And one thing that happened too.
Do you think it was the dog or the fact that he was a minister, or the combination of, was just so extreme? But
I think it was a combination of. Here's a man who teaches right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you got here a wrong that's attacking a right.
Mm-hmm.
But the other church that opened after Reverend Tucker's church was a Baptist church. And that was Reverend Mike Swine's church. Mm-hmm. And Reverend Mike Swine's children got involved. And that's one of the reasons I think that, his son was involved in the Genesis. What happened was his son was in jail. And it was I who went into the jail and found him there, and he had been beaten and went down to get him out.
This is Welton?
Welton McSwine. Mm-hmm.
That was very early on.
Right. But I think that Reverend McSwine sort of felt a commitment dating back from that incident. He knew that we were real. But I think that what Reverend McSwine was really waiting to see is how his congregation itself was going to take to us, more so him, because I don't think he felt as if he wanted to lose those few dollars mm-hmm. that was coming into the church. And with him being a black businessman too, you know.
What else did he was in the business? Or?
Yes, he owned a mortuary.
He didn't want to risk his reputation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was his livelihood for his family and him. Anything else. All of his business.
I managed to talk to him. His memory wasn't all that good, but he told me that the thing that pushed him over the edge in terms of opening his church was when Dick Gregory came to town and said something about, isn't it a shame we can't get a single Baptist church in Greenwood to open up, and he felt publicly embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what...
Yeah, he was embarrassed. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what I didn't understand is understanding the Methodist Church as growing up as an AME. And I knew the history of the AME Church. You know, why it divested itself from the Methodist Church in the Genesis. Reverend Poe, Reverend Allen, I'm sorry, Bishop Allen. I didn't think that the Methodist Church in Greenwood that was pastored by Reverend Black at that time would be as difficult to get into as it was.
He pastored the AME church there?
No, the Methodist church itself.
I'm a little bit, I'm not too
the good. The AME is African Episcopal Methodist Church.
Right.
The Methodist church is under the global ministries
sure.
and what have you. And he was a part of that particular organizational structure.
Okay, so Reverend Black is part of the traditional
right.
Methodist church.
And we called hell getting his participation of cooperation. Matter of fact, he fought the movement in the Genesis more than the Baptist churches did themselves. The Baptist church did maintain a silence, but he was just vocally open about his resentment of us being there.
You think he felt threatened?
I really don't know. I haven't analyzed it. But yes, thinking back, looking back, knowing now the Methodist Church structure, yes, and who runs the Methodist Church, you know, and what have you.
There's this argument that historians have been putting forth lately that part of the opposition to the church, well, let me back up. One thing that I think is fascinating is that I think there's a myth that exists that all black churches suddenly threw their arms open to the movement. You all certainly realize, but I mean, I think there's a lot of people want to believe that. But the argument that people are putting forth is that they had always been traditional leaders, and suddenly here was you and Moses and everyone's challenging for leadership in the black community, and that they basically felt threatened, you know, defending their own turf, but...
No. They didn't feel threatened by my and Moses being there, they felt threatened more from the white power structure itself. It was an economic thing. Most of the ministers around there who ran small churches were also employed by some whites there in the town. It was all about economics. Their wives either worked across the border for someone who was in local government there, or it was a means of survival, you know.
Yeah.
And it threatened that economic survival, you know, that wife or that minister himself, you know, of having us into their churches. Because many of the ministers I learned later on had been told that if we were let into the churches, that the church would be bombed. And many of the churches they did attempt to bomb them. They burned them down and everything else. But that was when that ultimate sacrifice came. And it's not because of the ministers themselves threw their arms open. It was the people in the community saying, hey, this is our church. Now, whether you want us to have a meeting in it or not, we're going to have it. And it was because of that pressure from the community itself that forced them to open up, whether they wanted to or not. It was the people.
What about Reverend Rucker at Wesley Methodist?
Reverend Rucker is an ass.
Okay. You want to elaborate on that? You want to elaborate on that?
I think Reverend Rucker was more against the movement itself, period. We had a lot of problems out of Reverend Rucker. Matter of fact, the way his church was open is that we had to go to his bishops.
Bishop Golden.
Yeah. Who came down and said, if you won't open the church, then I will.
He actually came to Greenway?
Yeah. And it was that, you know, from the bishop himself who came down. It was that pressure that the bishop himself applied on Reverend Rucker. To force the church open.
Yeah, Hollis had remembered that story. The same thing, fear?
Fear. Mm-hmm. Fear. And also, Reverend Rucker's church was located closer to the white community than the other churches. Right? Whereas the other black churches that we were into then were sort of protected in a community life. You know, whereas Reverend Cherokee's church was right there, right behind his church, nearly two blocks or three blocks over, began the white resident.
So he was very, his church was the most vulnerable.
Yeah. But the thing is, see, even though we could not get into his church, Reverend Rucker himself never attended any mass meetings outside of that church of his.
He really played it cautiously.
That's right. And the other churches that we couldn't get into, matter of fact, when I left Greenwood, I don't remember getting into this, and that's the Holiness churches. Other than Reverend Johnson, there's another Holiness church. Mm-hmm.
Very ignorant here, but is there a philosophical difference between Methodism and Baptism that explains that? There was more. I mean, why the Methodist Church is?
Methodist Church was ran by a black organization itself. The AME is totally black. See, when the
so Turner's Chapel and Wesley Methodist were both under the AME?
No. Wesley was under the Methodist structure. That's what I meant. It wasn't Reverend Black, because Reverend Black was over at Turner Chapel. You back up. Correct that. But we never got that much support from Reverend Black still when he came to Turner Chapel. But Reverend Rucker over there, his church is under a different organizational structure.
Right. So AME was a black offshoot of the traditional Methodist, so it made sense that Reverend Rucker's church would open up.
That's
okay,
right.
Now, Wesley Methodist is under the traditional white Methodist structure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that would have made it harder for Reverend Rucker.
Yes, he had to. Reverend Rucker had to.
But he had a black bishop, didn't he?
Yes, he did. That didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm.
But there were, in other words, there were two separate hierarchies.
Yes, there were two separate hierarchies.
I see.
Yeah. And he had to coalesce also with the other white Methodist ministers in that area, mm-hmm. which made me think at times, the way he would act, that he had to he moved and did what they said or told him to do. I don't think that he was really responsible for his own actions.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Baptist church? I mean, the opposition there was just, again, they were under too much pressure.
Too much pressure. And their national leadership was not at all a endorser of the movement.
You're talking about the black Baptist national leadership?
Yes, and Reverend Jackson. Matter of fact, many times some of the ministers had said, well, when our national organization vote on it, you know, then we'll probably, you know, become a part of the movement, but right now our national organization has told us to stay clear of all of this.
And who were the leaders now?
Reverend Jackson.
And where was he located?
I don't know where Reverend Jackson was. National Baptist.
Okay. All right, after that helps explain that.
Mm-hmm.
What about, you mentioned Reverend Johnson and Mr. Jordan. And some of the other people. What about the other people that, I mean, they made the contributions that matter in Greenwood?
Mr. Sanders, his family.
After he moved from Mr. Campbell's building.
And what happened in Mr. Campbell's building is I was en route to Jackson to a meeting with Meg Evers and Bob and some other people. And it was about 6 o'clock that afternoon. Friday or Saturday or something. Saturday, I think.
Is this before you left to go on your speaking engagement?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was about 6:30. That's what it was. It was just getting dark. Heard all these fire trucks in the community and thing. And we looked out of the window, and there was the office, Mr. Campbell's building, up in smoke. So I rush out of the house and over to the building. And when I got there, I was arrested for arson.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
And thrown in jail. But that too took on another dimension of the movement, because we weren't, at that point, I don't think, we weren't getting as many people out as we really wanted to get to the community and to down to the courthouse or whatever. But them throwing me in jail and holding me like that and charging me with arson, people came from everywhere. Out of the cotton fields with dirty boots on. When they had my trial in the little kangaroo court, one of the things that we saw was most of the people that were there, that packed the courtroom, packed around the courthouse, the little jail, were people who had come out of the fields. And that's when the movement really began to take on another dimension. And one of the things that they offered that really solidified the movement more, and our participation there and staying there, was that one of the things that they offered me was that if I would leave Greenwood and not stir up any more trouble, they'd drop all the charges against me and let me go. I refused to leave. and got again and still the faith in the people that were there and around them. They said, hey, you know.
It also made them look like tremendous hypocrites.
Yes, it did. It exposed them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, so you're going to talk about, so then after the arson attempt, or after the arson.
After the arson, we went, Mr. Sanders offered his building. Mr. Sanders himself had been employed by the city and helped to build manholes all over the city there in Greenwood, and was well known, had properties near everywhere. He offered his building free of charge at that time, and there was a little church in the bottom of his building, not about the size of this room here. And we began to use that church too as little meeting places for SNCC and for the community organizations that was beginning to organize itself. The NAACP youth group and all that began to organize. All this came out from the students, you know, who had been involved with us in Clarksdale. What happened too in Mr. Sanders' building, we went in, it was an old shell, we decided that we'd make a library for the community and have offices there and everything else and a place for us to work out of. A lot of people came down from all parts of the country and began to donate their times, and students in Michigan State and all everywhere began to donate books. Ivanhoe Dinerson began to drive stuff down, was driving down and had aspirins, you know, some over-the-counter drugs, and they sent us transport narcotics and arrested him. Just all kind of things happened. And Mr. Sanders, though he was always set in his own ways, you couldn't tell him anything. He sort of wanted to run the movement, per se, by being in his building. He gave a new strength to the movement. And that new strength was, even though the government and the people, the city, you know, thought that they had burned us out, they ran us out, Mr. Sanders gave us that staying power that we needed. He helped us to further the cause by offering his building and opening not only his building, he opened up his house to us, and so did his family.
So he sort of became sort of the embodiment of that philosophy of CIA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, was he someone who had been active in Mr. Jordan's
attempts? He was. Oh, yeah. But earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But matter of fact, too, Mr. Sanders was very active throughout. He was one of the persons of whom were active throughout the genesis of my being there. And doing whatever loop and anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there was not an NAACP chapter when you came to Greenwood. Was there one formed by Mr. Jordan's son shortly after you arrived?
No, that's not what happened. His son didn't really form NAACP. The students really began to start that. I put some people, told them that they should have an NAACP chapter. And they began to get that started. And through that, Andrew Jordan, you know, got involved.
These are high school students, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just elected president or whatever?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
If I can remember, what had happened, too, is that he had gotten involved in the movement somewhat, but he had gotten kicked out of his job.
Andrew Jordan?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your relationship with two people. First, Amzie, and then Aaron Henry. I guess you had grown up knowing Amzie for years.
Yes, I always knew of Amzie and always knew of the things that he was doing, you know, his involvement within WCP. And my thing was, is I always would like to go and talk to Amzie. I spent a lot of time at times talking to Amzie about various things that were happening and what, you know, I expressed the feeling that I wanted to do something. He was a man that I really, really respected. because around in the town in Cleveland, the only person who was really addressing any issues, period, regardless of how small or how large they are, was Amzie himself. He's a man who sacrificed himself in the post office, you know, had a good job, but they busted him down to a janitor of the post office and all that and gave him a few hours a day because of his active, you know.
Mm-hmm. When did that occur? Was that in the 50s? Or
yes, that was in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. And that was primarily, I mean, Moses mentioned that was primarily because he was working at Mount Bayou, or...
Oh, yeah, not only that, but he spoke out very heavily about what had happened in the Teals case. very, very heavily.
So he was just he was basically one of the few people on the Delta that was willing to take a stand in the 50s.
That took a stand.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the few.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Aaron Henry...
So he before we leave several people have talked about that it seemed that Amzie and Bob sort of had a special relationship.
They had a very, very special relationship. They understood each other. The ideologies were the same, you know, and I think that Amzie sort of served more as a teacher to Bob than anything else, because Amzie's running was not just about Cleveland, Mississippi, about injustices and things that were going on throughout the South, but it was about the state of Mississippi. He was well-traveled throughout the state of Mississippi. He knew people in areas who could get Bob into doors that Bob could not have gotten into himself.
Mm-hmm.
Amzie was really the father of, the movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In fact, Bob spent most of his time with Amzie at all times. Anytime he had a question that he couldn't deal with, he would call Amzie.
Was that true in when you get as late as the summer of 64?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Now, one thing that I think that Bob and Amzie differed on, and that was about bringing all of the white students into Mississippi all at once to converge upon the state of Mississippi. I think there's a difference in that, you know, between them. But it really didn't serve as a show. But there were a few of us who knew about it. Because, like Peacock and myself, Peacock and I were very close to Amzie too. And I was adamantly against bringing all the students in, be it black, blue, white, or green, into the state of Mississippi. And at that time, especially whites, because I didn't think that the timing was right. And one of the main reasons I felt that we should not have brought them in, and Amzie sort of agreed, well, Amzie did agree, right, was that we felt that they were coming in to sabotage the movement, and that it was going to be infested and then infiltrated with CIA men, FBI men, and everybody else. And the movement is going to be taken over by that group of people. It's going to be destroyed.
You all verbalized that as one of the arguments?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Matter of fact, that is one of the reasons why Peacock and I became a sore thumb in the movement. And, this sort of pushed us to the side.
Mm-hmm.
And Stokely had come in then also, and Stokely really wanted to take control over what was happening in Greenwood because of, you know, the magnitude of the movement itself. And the thing, the activities, was exciting too. And it was not only exciting, but it was exciting in a way where we could see progress being made.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about Aaron Henry?
Aaron Henry, honestly, I really never had that much respect for him, and I still don't. I just never saw Aaron as being that person who is that committed to the cause itself, per se. But I saw Aaron's commitment more of a selfish thing and more of egotistical reasons for being involved than Amzie. He stood out just like a sore thumb in my opinion. And also, AMSI was concerned about all groups working together, not caring about who gets the credit, whereas Aaron Henry was just the opposite. He wanted everything to be brought under the umbrella of the NAACP, and that's when finally we all agreed that, you know, COFO would serve as the umbrella organization. And AMSI always even, not AMSI, but Aaron, always even fought that. I rarely remember Aaron Henry coming into Green Board or other places to speak or other places where he's requested or needed, whereas AMSI was always there. Anytime, day or night. I don't care if it's 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you call AMSI, he's there. Mm-hmm. And Aaron Henry was just the opposite.
Did he put any pressure on you? I mean, when you were in Greenwood, I mean, did he ever communicate with you when you were in Greenwood in the early stages?
Who, Aaron?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he put pressure on you.
Is that one of the reasons why you formed the NAACP chapter there, or
well,
was that
no,
his
I
idea?
Saw,
or?
No. The reason was is that we needed some kind of catalyst, or some kind of organization that young people can really begin to identify with, other than just SNCC itself. You had more older people involved in SNCC in Greenwood at the level, you know, than you had youngsters. So we needed something that we could get them to organize around, to bring, you know, other youth into the movement to further the cause.
Did he come down and meet with them?
No. Mega did. Mm-hmm.
What was Medgar's relationship to, first to you all, then to the people in Greenwood?
There was a serious resentment because SNCC had come in and had been able to do some of the things, I think, that the NAACP had wanted to do and had not been able to do.
So you felt that Medgar resented?
In the Genesis, yes, he did. But Medgar, in my opinion, was much, much sharper than Aaron Henry politically. And his coming into Greenwood and speaking at mass meetings were more political, for political reasons, you know, personal politics, than anything else, to show his commitment to go. He couldn't allow himself to be outside of that organization, of that movement. So it was political.
So he came basically just to inject the NAACP's endorsement of,
yes,
of something that was beyond his control,
right,
that he was,
right,
in fact, jealous of.
Right. Mm-hmm. He had no control of that. Nobody did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But how did the people respond to him? I mean, when
he was accepted because they didn't know the anthropolitics,
mm-hmm,
what's going on. Anything that happened like that, we always kept it in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you knew that if there was any way that we could destroy a movement, it was from within.
Mm-hmm.
Most people knew that, and there would be no movement.
Mm-hmm. So what would, if you were if you communicate with Henry or with Mecca, what would be the nature of the conversation, or what would you talk about?
The need for food and, you know, and clothing, mm-hmm, and the area and that stuff. And it would give us a little bit, you know, and that sort of stuff. But Megan would come and he'd give, you know, speeches, and, you know, when needed to. Megan was an eloquent speaker, and he could come in, he could help rally people at times, and he could help also by his being there. People who were committed to NAACP across the country, you know, he could broaden that support that we needed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Mississippi, that we weren't able to get to as, you know, ourselves as SNCC field secretary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's so, what it did, it showed more of a cohesiveness of the organization itself, you know, the organizations, than just SNCC, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we needed that broad support, because We didn't care whether a person was an NAACP member, core, or what, you know. We knew that there was a need to broaden the support in whatever means necessary or you know, that we could.
Mm-hmm. You said earlier that you thought that to some degree Henry fought even Kofo.
Yes, he did.
Do you think Medgar did, or do you think Medgar
probably accepted? No, I don't think Medgar did. There's a difference, as much difference between Medgar and Aaron as there was night and day.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't agree on a lot of philosophies of, you know, themselves, but that never got out.
Mm-hmm. After you came back then from your fundraising tour,
mm-hmm.
You went back to work in Holmes County.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Because Greenwood was what, too hot to sort of.
Greenwood had, the people had taken the movement on then, and you had a lot of people who had come in from other areas, had been pulled out of other areas into Greenwood there. It had become the focus point,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all of our efforts were going to be concentrated just in that area. But at the same time, I saw that there was a lack of, what's his name, God, Bob Ray, Jim Ray? I can't think of the fellow's name. Anyway, he had been in Holmes County and had spent some time down there talking to people. And he asked me to come in and organize. He was from Greenwood. So I went in and I worked with him around in Holmes County.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because of what had happened in Greenwood, people were a lot more receptive to me than they were to him.
Because you've been able to get something going,
right?
Mm-hmm. Was there a difference working in a more rural county like Holmes, or the difference between the two counties?
There's a difference, yes. Though Holmes County, the majority of the population, people there were black, and they were, you know, landowners. I had a lot more fear in me for some reason going in those areas than I did when I was in Greenwood for some reason. And though I knew that I was, more supported. I mean, the people in Holmes County supported me a lot more right from the genesis than those in Greenwood. But that was because of the history that had been already been established, you see. And for some reason, I just really never felt comfortable in Holmes County. And I never yet thought about trying to put my hand on that reason. But I guess I'd gotten to the point that I was battle fatigued, and that so much had happened to me. And I was sort of getting to the point where I was feeling like I just might be killed at any minute now. And I just wasn't ready to die, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
The fear of death began to come over me. More so than anything else. That was the only difference. But as far as work, no, there's a lot of support.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have the problem getting into the churches in Holmes County that we had.
You didn't have that?
We didn't. No, no.
Mm-hmm. Even from Baptist churches?
No. From Baptist churches. No, we didn't have any. Because, see, most of the people in Holmes County were farmers themselves. They owned their own land and stuff around in that area. And economically, they were much more stable. Or, you know, when they owned their own churches, they didn't have to adhere to anyone
mm-hmm.
around them.
Mm-hmm. So you did that through that summer?
Yes, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Then you had the Freedom Vote campaign.
Yeah, we had the mock election.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, did you work in Greenwood during that, or
Greenwood, Holmes County, Belzona?
What did you do? Anything specific?
Dealt with issues.
Mm-hmm.
Issues.
Did you, was there a much discussion about who was going to be, about putting Henry on the slate?
In the Genesis of Mars, yes. Mm-hmm. Not many SNCC people really liked young Henry. And not many people who were working with the NAACP really liked Aaron Henry. Mm-hmm. So yes, there was quite a bit of friction and discussion. And some people around in some counties like LaFleur County and Holmes County didn't know that much about Aaron Henry. He had not been as visible as A. Amzie Moore or as a Mother Evers or people or Fannie Lou Hamer. People just seem to have had that back mind and skepticism, about Aaron Henry in all times. What is that after me?
Was there much discussion about putting Ed King on the ballot? Or?
Yes, mm-hmm. Quite a bit. Ed was very respected because of his early involvement in the movement. Well known, well respected. Spent some time in Greenwood. And he got known, and there were some skepticism because, he'd been white and in Mississippi. But people weren't just really ready to come out and just place the trust in him, that I would want to them to have had, or Peacock or Bob Moses would want them to have had. People had just not gotten over the fact that he is the enemy that we're fighting.